good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday. It's Friday. It's Friday, everybody. Good morning. We made it. It's been a week. And we're here. It's the 7th of November. It's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we couldn't be more thrilled to have you with us today. We have a lot going on. We have a big group today. We'll talk about that in a second. And then we have a lot to talk about. It's still busy out there from what I can tell. And we always welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, and we'd love to have you join us. We will try to get to as many letters as possible. It's not possible to get to everyone, but we try to get the mood of the room and look and see and get different viewpoints as we work our way throughout the panel this morning. Let me introduce our group to you. First, Judith Enk is here, senior fellow and faculty member in the Center for the Advancement of Public Action, also known as CAPA. At Bennington College, she is the president of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator, and co-author of the new book, out December 2nd, The Problem with Plastic. And it's a great honor, as always, to welcome Judith Enk to the program. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks. And thanks for plugging the book. I want to invite everyone to our very first book launch party, December 3rd at Bennington College in Kappa, 7 o'clock. And then January 22nd, I'll be at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck at 6 p.m.
Nice. Yeah, good. You're doing the tour.
I'm doing the tour. I was trying not to do the tour, but I seem to be in like 8 different cities now.
Well, I have to say, at least those two you just mentioned, ace places to be.
And so convenient.
Yes. I mean, just absolutely terrific
places. I wanted to do the first one at Bennington College, my home. So that's December 3rd.
Very
come on out.
Nice. Okay. Well, that's a Wednesday night, I believe.
Yeah. Bennington. Yeah. It's closer than you think.
Yes.
Right over the
Well, to me,
line.
It's very close. Yeah, so I'm very, very excited.
No reason for you not
no,
to show
I will
up.
No, I will be there,
no,
I
no,
promise.
No. It's
the day after my mother-in-law's birthday, so I'll have to go to
and
your
the
thing.
The day before my birthday.
Oh, really? Oh, very nice.
Big week.
We also welcome the ever wonderful Erin Pasidi is with us, Siena University professor of economics and our dear friend. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good morning. This was
it seemed a little muted, but okay.
Sure. I've got nothing to promote. I've got nothing particularly exciting.
No dates. No
dates. No.
No gigs.
No gigs. The bands have been kind of quiet lately. Actually, no. I do have an announcement. I do have something to promote. One of the bands I'm in, Wide Margin. They're all original tunes written by a wonderful songwriter in Battenville, Dave Cute. We recorded some demos over the summer, and those are now available on all streaming platforms.
Very nice. Very good. Is the studio right there in Battenville?
The studio is his basement.
Okay.
So, yeah, sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all
studio
you do.
Battenville. Yeah. The Bard of Battenville's house. Yeah.
Bard of Battenville. beautiful. You have once again brought us three amazing students from Siena University. And I'll say this every time, but it's I love having Siena here because, well, first of all, I love having students on the show. Well, we can't have enough students as far as I'm concerned. That's the best, absolute best. And to have them from, we have them from all over. But when we have them from Siena, that was my dad's alma mater. That was where I was supposed to go to school.
But you went to St. Rose.
But I went to St. Rose because they had a communications department. But my dad allowed it because it was St. Rose.
Good.
And you can read into what that whatever you want to, but I think you can probably figure it out.
And you had a great experience.
I had an amazing experience.
We all did. We're all rosebuds.
At heart, yes, indeed. Before I introduce the students, let me also introduce. I forgot. I skipped right over her. CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, is here. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
Good, late again, but thank you for trying to give me grace. I appreciate it.
You were right on time, actually.
Yeah. Well,
and that couldn't have been a better time.
I was
entrance.
Listening on the radio. I'm like, oh, okay, I need to park really fast and get in there. But
I can just pick you up. And then you'd be on time.
I would have been late anyways because I was in the barn with a horse with a bad foot. And I was putting a poultice and vet wrap on his foot. Hot pink vet wrap. Wow. So
That's a good excuse for being late.
Out in the field. Well, it's usually, frequently horse or dog related that I'm not on time. But it's also something like, it's not like they're new. I know I have them. You'd think I'd be able to plan better, but it's just not my genetic makeup.
Well, also in days like today, you can say to yourself, well, he's going to introduce the kids first, so I have time.
Yeah, I never have time. That's the truth.
All right. We have wonderful young students, young people with us today. They're young adults. They're adults. And I shouldn't call them kids, but by comparison, but I'm thrilled that they're here and they're filled with energy and good fortune. They are majors in economics from Siena University. Let me introduce them to you. Josh Florence is here. Hello, Josh. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
Excellent. Where's home base for you, Josh?
Well, Glenville, New York.
Okay.
Not too far. I love Siena. It's the greatest school.
What year are you in at Siena?
I'm a senior, approaching the end of my time
there. So then what?
Well, I just said I was approaching the end, but I'm weighing it. I'm still weighing the decision, but I might be going back for a fifth year for my master's.
Oh, well, that's good.
Good.
Well, good for you. And the master's would be in economics?
Yes.
Well, good for you. And then the hope would be, what would you like to use that degree for?
Well, I wish I had anything specific, but mainly just some sort of economic research, whatever that entails.
You want to make the world a better place.
By spewing my opinions onto anybody listening.
Welcome to this show.
Yeah, really.
Here we are. We're also very happy to have Giovanna Perez with us. Giovanna, hello. How are you?
Hi.
It's so nice to see you and to meet you. Welcome. What year are you in?
I'm also a senior at Siena.
And what's the game plan? What do you hope to do?
I'm taking a gap year to try to find maybe a paralegal job because I also have a pre-law certification from Siena. So I'm trying to figure out how to get a paralegal job in the city because I've I am a legal assistant at a law firm in the city called Dark Campbell Owsley Kuhlerberg. I think they changed their name actually, but I haven't been there.
It doesn't matter. All it means is that there'll be a new coffee cup when you go there the next time. But that's in Brooklyn, or?
No. So I'm from Queens, New York.
Oh, you're from Queens.
And so I work at a law firm in the financial district of Manhattan.
Nice. Good for you. Well, congratulations, and we look forward to hearing from you throughout the morning this morning. We also welcome to our microphones Carrie Ann Wise. Carrie Ann, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Where's home base for you?
Long Island.
All right. And what is also a senior?
I'm a junior.
A junior. Yes. And what brought you to Siena? What made you think, that's the place for me?
I came from a small school, and Siena was also a small school. I love that, tight-knit community feel.
Yeah.
And they had a lot to offer. I'm also a data science major, and it's a very niche major, and it's one of the few schools that had that as well.
Do those two go well together, both economics and data science?
I hope so. I've been told that, but
I'm finding out now. Actually.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And then the idea would be to do what?
Kind of data analysis is the goal, but in the economics field, hopefully.
Okay. Does that track, Aaron?
It tracks.
Yeah. And how does that? Because it would seem to me that would be a very important part of the equation.
Yeah,
economists.
A lot of what economists do is, try to construct arguments and make predictions based on data sets. So they do pair well together.
Excellent. Well, I can't tell you how happy we are to have you in the studio this morning. It's a thrill and welcome aboard. Again, anytime you want to say anything or to jump in, just do that or raise your hand, and I will call on you immediately. And we want to hear what you have on your minds this morning. Okay, there are so many things to talk about today, and they're sort of a more eclectic group of stories, perhaps, than normal. But we will we'll get through a lot of things. I think journalistically, I would start with the FAA story and the airports, and that's where I would begin. I will say we spent a good amount of time on that yesterday, and we'll spend some time on it today as well. So I'm just going to hold that as our top story and instead go to the fact that the political story for here in New York as well, but this is a national story. There's no question about it for a lot of reasons. But Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from the 21st Congressional District in New York, she is my congresswoman. She is Aaron's congresswoman. Anybody else? No?
Not okay. Mine.
She is running, going to announce that she's running for governor, we believe, today. I think she has announced that it will be later today that she will make it official that she's running for governor. No real surprise here, except the fact that after she was going to take a job in the Trump administration, and she was poised and ready to go. And then they were worried about the numbers, or at least this is what they're saying. They were worried about the numbers in the House, so they put that on hold. And then the next thing you know, she's sort of out. She's out of leadership. She's out of all of those things that she had been in prior to that. And shortly thereafter is when she started to make some hints that she was going to run against Kathy Hochul in New York State, assuming that Kathy Hochul is the Democratic candidate. But I think suffice to say, regardless of that, right now she's running against Kathy Hochul. So we'll see what she has to say about this later on. She's a conservative upstate New York Republican, close ties to the White House, and will announce she will run for governor next year. The move, which is expected to be announced in a video, sets up a ferocious political battle between one of President Trump's fiercest allies and Kathy Hochul, a moderate Democrat. The contest is likely to be one of the key races in next year's crucial midterm elections. A spokesman for Ms. Stefanik would not comment about her plans. The people familiar with her intentions were not authorized to discuss them and cautioned the timing could still change. Ms. Stefanik is 41 years old. She began her career as a Harvard-educated moderate working in the White House of former President George W. Bush and for Paul Ryan, the 2012 Republican vice presidential nominee. But since Mr. Trump's first election, she has moved ever closer to the center of his orbit. She was a visible defender during his impeachments and amplified his lies about the 2020 election. Later, her viral showdowns with Ivy League university presidents about anti-Semitism on campuses helped push several to resign. This is the reporting from the New York Times. Those qualities have brought her enormous fundraising numbers and a national reputation among Republicans, but have also saddled her with baggage that could encumber her in a state that Democrats have governed for decades. Ms. Stefanik has made no secret about her eagerness to challenge Ms. Hochul, who has faced middling poll numbers for much of her tenure. Many of the congresswoman's recent moves could be seen as a preview of her campaign strategy, conflating Ms. Hochul with Zohran Mamdani, now the mayor-elect of New York City, and running as their foil. That, again, from the New York Times. Oh, Judith Enck, what say you?
Well, do remember you mentioned this, that Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado is running against Governor Hochul in a primary. Stefanik is...
Has he officially announced?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know.
Yes. I mean, I know that was the intention. I just didn't know whether he officially announced. But okay, go ahead.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's great that Stefanik is running for three reasons. One is there will be a contrast between her and presumably Governor Hochul or Lieutenant Governor Delgado. A huge contrast. So voters will not be confused. The second reason why I think it's good is because she's going to lose. And then the third reason I think it's good is because we need to point out that you're in public service for the public good. And if you look at Elise Stefanik's career, it is really dominated by her starting out as a supposed moderate, and then she hitched her wagon to Trump. And that's not a good place to be today. Separate from that, you just have to have some principled bottom lines. And as far as I can tell, she has none. In her career in Congress, she does not stand up for the Affordable Care Act. She is not good on climate change. She doesn't stand up for education funding. She's a divider. I've never heard her speak out against racism. I think the way she beat up the college presidents during the hearings was pretty disturbing. And she was my Congress member for a short period of time. I really can't think of one thing that she has accomplished. I can't remember one town hall meeting that she's had. And apparently she's not good at math, because there are 6.4 million Democrats enrolled in New York State, 3 million Republicans, and 3.4 million independents. Often the independents will decide this. And if I was her, I would have waited a little bit to analyze what happened this past Tuesday on Election Day. And others have done that. Bruce Blakeman, who just won re-election in Nassau County, is flirting with running, and there might be a primary. But my goodness, running during the midterms with the New Yorkers having really serious concerns about Trump, whether it's cutting SNAP funding or his reckless foreign affairs policies, I think if she's serious about winning, she's made a mistake, and I think it's great she's running.
We'll take a break. We'll get to our other panelists in just a moment. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's Friday morning. It's the 7th of November, and we're thrilled to have a great group here in Studio A. And we're talking about Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from the 21st District in the state of New York, who is expected today to launch her campaign to challenge Governor Kathy Hochul, or we assume that will be the matchup. At very least, she is announcing that she will run for governor as a Republican candidate. So all of that coming up. We were talking to Judith Enck about this. So you, let me go to back to you, and then we'll hear from our other panelists as well.
Let me just wrap up my rather unkind commentary on Elise Stefanik. So it's not just that she is a zebra mussel attached to Trump. It's also her policies. That's an invasive species found in the water. It's her policies are just awful. So on environmental issues, she has a 2024 voting score of zero. To be fair, her lifetime score is 26%. So you see the change. But in 2024, she voted the wrong way on lead poisoning prevention, on protecting drinking water. She voted to obstruct appliance efficiency standards, so we don't save money on our utility bills. And she's very pro-fracking.
And let us just point out geographically also a representative within the Adirondack Park.
Right, right. You would think
so there
she
is
would,
that.
Yeah, and people like to drink water without PFAS chemicals in it and not have lead in consumer products. But, you know, the thing about Kathy Hochul is I have some real serious concerns about her policies of late, particularly on climate change, that she's walking back the state's commitments on climate change. I really hope she does not approve the fracked gas pipelines, the Williams-Nessie pipelines and others, because the New York State DEC already rejected those pipelines and now she's resurrecting them. And this will be an early test for the new DEC commissioner and whether she follows the law or is susceptible to political pressure from the governor's office. So, you know, I have concerns with Governor Hochul's environmental record, but she is a serious elected official. She is in office to serve the public. She's speaking out against the SNAP cuts. I think she's having a hard time trying to figure out how to deal with Trump, and she's in a tough spot because we, as the state of New York, need to get federal tax dollars. I think it was smart that she endorsed Zohran Mamdani. I think she needs Zohran Mamdani more than Zohran Mamdani needs her to expand the electorate. But there's just comparing an opportunist politician like Stefanik to Hochul, who we may not agree with on everything, but I do think she is working in the public interest and she hasn't had ethics scandals and she's trying to improve the fate of the state. So it'll be an interesting race, but anything can happen. I would not rule out Bruce Blakeman because Republicans are strong on Long Island. And, you know, in fairness, you have to recognize that Antonio Delgado is also running, and a year is a long time in politics.
It certainly is. Aaron.
So I like how Judith phrased what I was thinking, and that is it's great she's running because she's most likely going to lose and get beat up. But I think this serves an additional purpose for Republicans, and that is it provides some visibility in a very big state, even though it's solidly blue, that you'll have some MAGA folks out there on the front lines that'll get Fox News interviews. And that's important in, you know, the midterms where most likely Republicans are going to take a beating across the country. That was kind of made clear on Tuesday. So I see why they're doing it. I don't think it's going to be successful. I'm also a little bit puzzled when, you know, Republicans have a finite amount of resources to spend in putting people up for particularly, you know, larger positions like governor and, you know, allocating their resources to somebody in a state that's solidly blue doesn't seem like a good use of money. Like there might be purple states or there might be more competitive congressional races. So I'm a little bit baffled by that. But what we're going to hear is the normal populist, you know, Trump agenda about, you know, there's an affordability crisis, which there is in parts of New York. Taxes are too high. We need to lower regulations. It's going to be more of the same. But I think time is on Democrat side because the more string you give Trump for his policies to play out, the worse the economy is going to get. So trying to run as a, you know, MAGA Republican when the economy is becoming increasingly fragile to the point where the word recession is starting to get tossed around is going to very likely backfire. So that's my political analysis. But I also wanted to chime in with some sociological analysis about something Judith said. And I know people kind of laughed when I did this, but in 2016, when Trump won, I decided that I was going to watch all of The Apprentice season one to figure out what this dude's all about, because I had no idea what he was besides some shyster businessman. If you watch, you don't even need to watch the whole first season. I mean, bless your heart if you do. The first few episodes tell you everything you need to know about Trump. He is a bully. He enjoys being boss. He enjoys debasing and degrading people by making them do his bidding in embarrassing ways so he seems more powerful. And you see this with Stefanik. You see this with the unprincipled stand of being a modest pro-business Republican under Bush and then turning to the election was stolen. I don't know, you know, pick your random MAGA thing that she's gotten behind. But the thing that bothers me the most debasing thing that she has done to herself, this is a Harvard law grad. Her tweets, was this last year or 2 years ago? All of a sudden started to appear in all caps. The grammar got worse. And for somebody like that to be so unprincipled that you're going to change the way you write and communicate, it's just embarrassing. And these are not people we want in office. That's a sign that she is in this for self-preservation. She's in this to serve her own needs. She's not in it, as Judith mentioned, to serve the public. And it's just a sign of the power Trump has over people to essentially become an entirely different person.
Heather Mulligan.
Woo! Well, first off, 1 year ago, roughly, give or take a few days, there was a huge and surprising upsurge in Republican turnout and people crossing the lines to vote for a Republican who had a history and a track record of doing the kinds of things that he's doing right now.
Lee Zeldin?
No. 1 year ago.
Okay.
1 year ago. It would be Donald J. Trump.
Oh, him.
Yeah, that guy, right?
Sure.
And so for my purposes, I think it is premature to predict what will happen 1 year from today. I think we've seen a huge rebuke and a stain on the Republican Party because of some of the policies that I think are extremely ill-advised and unpopular and ineffective. I don't know that that will be the case 1 year from now. I don't. I have no way of saying. We also don't know who the full field is. I mean, the hot rumor du jour is that de Blasio is now going to step in. And if you remember, he announced that he was running in 2022 and then changed his mind. But, you know, certainly there's a lot of people seeing an opportunity with respect to Governor Hochul, who I actually think has done a pretty good job on a number of issues in being a moderate, which represents the entirety of the state and not just where there is an extremely large concentration of power at the state level based out of the New York City metropolitan market. So, I mean, I do surveys. We're a statewide organization. I do surveys of our members on economic issues. They would say, you know, across the board that the economic condition of the state is not good right now. And whether or not that the view is that that is because of something nationally or at the state level is going to be a very large factor in the election next year. The popular, I mean, it's going to be a proxy between, I've seen both the ads, by the way, both are out. Elise Stefanik's announcement video, which is several minutes long, I think very long for a political ad. And you know, I don't think a lot of people sit and watch a YouTube video for 2+ minutes. It's already out. It's very, very clear that it's going to be about out-migration, affordability, the economy, and very, very clearly the incoming mayor of New York City. Vice versa, the governor very quickly had an ad up sort of rebuking Stefanik, and it's all about Trump. It's all about her standing in front of a Trump sign, her saying that she's his largest supporter, his most loyal first person to endorse him, all of those things. So right now the strategy is Trump versus Mamdani, which is interesting since Mamdani is not even in office yet, right? But it's Trump versus Mamdani plus economy affordability on both sides. I don't know how people are going to sort through that. I do know New York, you know, huge Democratic enrollment edge, as Judith very correctly pointed out, makes it a really, really hard path for any Republican. I think that the calculus as to why Stefanik, I mean, I think one woman, do you run a man against a woman or do you run a woman against a woman? Two, name recognition. Certainly has the most name recognition out of any elected Republican woman in the state that I can think of. Is it winnable or not? I think it's anybody's guess. A million things could happen in a year. You look back a year and look at the numbers from that election cycle, and you look forward a year and the numbers from this election cycle. You know, there's a lot that can happen. That's pretty much the sum and substance of my thoughts on it. Not surprised that it's all about Trump versus Mamdani, because you know, nationally, I think the congressional Republicans who are very concerned about losing their majority, rightfully so, historically in a midterm, the party in power loses the majority. They think that this is a benefit to them. So I think it all remains to be seen, and what happens nationally and the city is going probably to determine how people feel in a year.
And remember, Lee Zeldin came very close.
He did,
when he ran. Now he's now destroying the EPA. That was his his consolation prize. But it's, I just think the political climate is so different this year and next.
When he ran in 2022 against Kathy Hochul, he received 46.7% of the votes. She received 53.1% of the vote. But and I know this is a fool's errand to do this, and I mean show pictures on the radio, but the map of New York and just a scattering of, I believe, 8 counties that went Democratic, but obviously the population centers and where the most people are. But as far as a growth opportunity for a Republican, or for a Democrat, for that matter, there are a lot of areas, and also interestingly enough, follows the Thruway.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah,
interesting. You show that because I did the math on that last night.
Of course you did.
It's a shame that trees don't vote. 60%
This is the Lorax, professor.
A little over 60% of the population lives in New York City, Albany, and the Buffalo, Syracuse, Rochester metro area. Those aligned with the map that Joe showed. So, yeah, when you look at a map of New York State, it's almost all red, except for these dark blue pockets.
The national version of that, it's the same thing.
It is the same thing.
But again, farmland doesn't vote.
Absolutely the same thing.
No, I know. So, luckily for Democrats, generally speaking, right?
That's why they're the Senate. So, right, yeah, that's the check on that.
You know.
We have to go to a break, but I just want to throw this out as a question, which is it not possible? I would think that Elise Stefanik, who has had national exposure for the last 10 years, is a bigger name than Lee Zeldin. And Lee Zeldin got almost 47% of the vote.
Yeah, I think a lot of things could happen. I mean, she's got name recognition. Her seat is generally viewed as a safe seat for Republicans, so they don't risk losing that seat. Now, I mean, I don't believe safe seat math, generally speaking. I think gerrymandering is sometimes a fool's errand, but having been moved into 3 different districts in like 2 years, right. And by the way, New York actually redistricted midterm before any of these other states did. I don't think anything is safe, and I don't think anything is decided at this point.
Although what is so different is Trump is destroying the nation. In many ways, the economy, the way immigrants are being kidnapped and injured by ICE, and Elise Stefanik owns that. Now, the mistake that Kathy Hochul can't make is she can't just run on anti-Trump Stefanik. She also needs to clearly define her agenda, and she will do that. But I just think it's a different world. Like, even week to week with Trump, I mean, I would just run pictures of him destroying the East Wing, which, by the way, they didn't do asbestos abatement on. And it's just going to get worse and worse every week he is in office.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We're talking right now about Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from the 21st Congressional District of New York, announcing running against or running for governor, and we assume running against Kathy Hochul. But we don't, obviously, that full field has not been announced yet, and we don't, or has been figured out by the voters. Let's put democracy into action there. Obviously, when you, as Heather so rightly put it before, when you look at her announcement and her video, she's running against Kathy Hochul. Mm-hmm. So, and Zoran Mandani.
Yeah.
Josh, what do you think?
Well, I think it might be too early to tell, but, Elise Stefanik is very, very pro-Trump at this point. And if things continue the way that they're going with, Republicans on the national level, I don't think that's going to benefit her in the long run. And I also think it's really important to pay attention to the Democratic primary in the midterms, in the New York gubernatorial race. Kathy Hochul could probably, she could probably be the candidate if she sort of embraces the new sort of progressive movement that we've sort of seen in the past election this Tuesday with the election of Zoran Mandani. But, it's hard to predict at this point. Like, as Heather said, it's things swing one way or the other all the time. It's it might be too early to say.
It's an interesting point. I also wonder about the idea of where Stefanik, where is she going to go for votes? And I think a lot of that's going to be in the areas, in those red areas within the state. But you're going to have to make a.
I mean, I could tell you the last time a Republican won statewide, the calculus was you needed to win something like, I don't know, less than 20% of the vote in New York City if you carried all of upstate and Long Island, right? That number is bigger now because the population is more concentrated in New York City. Upstate has lost hundreds of thousands of residents since that time. I mean, it was a while ago, right? It was the 90s. But there's no doubt that even in a low turnout election in the city, which, in a midterm, generally speaking, the turnout is lower. But you just saw record turnout in a mayoral, so who knows? But even with low turnout in the city, the number is bigger now. You need to win a bigger percentage of New York City, and you really need to win strongly in Long Island. And I think Zeldin actually carried enough of the city last time. He didn't get a big enough percentage in the suburbs and on Long Island in particular, which is where he's from.
I'm sorry. Just a quick question on election law. She can't run for both seats, right? She can't run for re-election as a congresswoman and run for
governor? I don't think so, because her congressional term is actually expiring, right? So, I don't think legally you can do that.
Okay.
If she was,
so that'll be an interesting race in and of itself.
Right. If she was a U.S. senator and she was in the middle of her term, she could run for governor and retain her seat if she didn't. She wouldn't have to vacate her Senate seat. But because her term is expiring, I think that, that's not a possibility.
You're running for two separate positions.
And don't assume that a Republican's going to win her seat, because on Tuesday there was a special election. Billy Jones resigned from the assembly, a Democrat, and the assumption was that a Republican would win his seat. But the mayor of Plattsburgh, Cashman, won that seat. There's a lot of overlap in that district. I just think the whole political map has changed. I just want to make this one point. I think Elise Stefanik, her biggest mistake is hitching her wagon to Trump. Her second biggest mistake was announcing today, because the map has changed, especially in New York City. There are so many more registered Democrats. And you were bringing us to how did the math work. If she was smart and not just a zebra muscle opportunistic candidate, she would have sat down with the pros and done the math. The math has changed. Now, I don't want to be like, it's a mistake to be overly optimistic about
the
future.
Don't get all Kornacki on us, yes. But go ahead.
But, you know, she'll win Staten Island. She'll win part of Long Island. She'll win Shenango County. I mean, the math doesn't math. And a true professional, like there was no reason for her to announce this early. A true professional would have sat down and looked at the political map and the political reality that we're facing. And, you know,
does the Republican Party have any true professionals?
Well, okay,
anymore?
I'm going to push back a little bit. First, I think the zebra muscle thing is really not kind. And I just,
I don't know.
She's debased herself. This is embarrassing for New Yorkers.
All right. So setting that aside, if nationally there is a lot of concern about a Democratic socialist winning fairly large in the largest city in the United States, there is a lot of donors that are sitting out there very worried. And the idea of announcing now would be to maximize the concern, to basically get as much money from the rest of the country in support of her candidacy as a counterpoint to a Democratic socialist who, you know, for better or for worse, is a scary prospect to a lot of people across the country. So I don't think that it's fool's errand to announce now. I don't think that it's all upside, but I do think that this is an opportunity to do some serious fundraising on her part.
She'll outraise Kathy Hochul. She's going to raise a ton of money, not including the super PACs and the dark money. I just don't think the math works, but which is great. I'm glad she announced today.
Well, I mean, the other thing about announcing today is you give yourself time and you give yourself to overcome what you just described. I mean, I think she's out there. She has more time to make money, but she also gets more time to barnstorm the state and, like all of us, see what happens. What develops.
I have seen her in a public setting speaking now years ago, right? Pre-Trump era. Very articulate, very smart. I mean, she didn't get there because, you know, she had some, you know, lucky streak or something. She earned her seat in Congress and did so. I mean, that at the time that she was elected, she was the youngest person ever elected to Congress.
Yeah.
That's no longer the case, but I actually looked it up, I think, last
Maxwell
time we're on.
Frost.
But she's not an unintelligent person. And so having time to, you know, let herself be known outside of the context of Trump, maybe she needs a lot of time for that. People don't like Trump.
But, you know, here she was after the 2024 election. And just a reminder, that was a year ago. It seems longer.
Yeah.
But she then, President Trump announces that she is his choice to be ambassador to the United Nations. And then wheel spinning. And then they take that away from her.
And she lost her leadership.
And she lost her leadership. And I can't imagine that, no matter what she says in public about Trump and the Trump administration, that's got to frost her, that she was on the front lines and had basically given up her political career for this guy and his ideology, and the rug was pulled out from under her.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it, I'm sure, was very, very difficult time. And, you know, the thinking at the time was that the House was so close and they would have to have a special election. And there was navigation by the Democrats in New York to say, well, we won't approve a special election until the absolute last minute. So there were a lot of moving parts in that decision. It wasn't just like, oh, we changed our mind. I don't think any of that is necessarily a factor here. I think the real factor is, you know, is there an opportunity? And I think nationally people think there is. I think if you asked me today, I think it's very, very tough road. I mean, the Republican brand is very, very tarnished right now. And there's going to have to be a lot of work to, you know, sort of recover from that.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue. I want to get to letters as well. We'll do all of that first. News from David Gustina. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Judith Enck is here, as is Heather Mulligan and Aaron Pasitti. We also are joined by three students from Siena University. They are all majors in the economics program at that university. Josh Florence, Carrie Ann Wise, and Giovanna Perez. And we'll hear from them in just a little bit as well. Some letters from our listeners on Elise Stefanik and the announcement that she is running for governor of New York State. Jay said, I don't agree with all of Stefanik's politics, but I do think that all the criticism is not valid. She is a millennial woman that's probably faced countless struggles just for simply being a young Republican woman in politics. Her district may not represent all of New York's demographics, but having nature as your background influences a person in ways that urban filth never will. Please give her a chance.
Is this a serious letter?
Yes.
I don't think anyone can make the case that she's not had a life of privilege. I don't think it's being at all unfair to point out her record in Congress, the fact that after the 2020 election, she stood firmly with the rioters who literally attacked Congress and law enforcement people died during that. And I think it's very telling that she chose to announce this historic candidacy via video. Now, a lot of elected officials do
that
now.
That's the thing. Yeah.
That's the thing. But it's also, I think, if she were to announce today in person, she would get a lot of questions about SNAP, about the airlines. And I with all due respect to the letter writer, I'm just not getting his point, because she's had a pretty charmed political life in the Republican Party. Now, it's, you know, unfortunate that Trump pulled the rug out from under her at the UN, but it's actually better that she's not at the UN.
There have been a lot of men who have debased themselves at the foot of Dear Leader as well. Mike Johnson. I mean, take your pick of, you know, men, MAGA Republicans who might have been, I mean, I don't know how an evangelical supports Trump's policies. Like, this has to be so antithetical to everything they believe in. Say what you want about evangelicals, at least they have a guiding life philosophy. Might not be one you agree with, but there's a philosophy
like
there.
Like feeding the poor.
Right, exactly. So how Mike Johnson can get behind, we need to first take Medicaid away from the poor to make it more difficult for them to get. Then we need to make it more expensive for them to buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. And while we're at it, let's make sure that they don't get any nutrition assistance. That's the same debasement in terms of what people are swallowing and what they have to do to stay in the good graces of what is just the mafia leader of the country at this point. So this is not a gender issue. This is something that is happening across the Republican Party.
All right. I'm sorry. I apologize.
I just wanted to say, I don't think privilege has anything to do with anything. I think women of privilege, men of privilege, including Mom Dami, who certainly is a person who grew up privileged, face challenges based on, you know, their gender, based on their religion, and overcoming those challenges is something that I think is admirable. I don't think that if someone grew up in a privileged household versus not, doesn't mean that they don't face adversity because of other attributes. So I just wanted to make that point.
But what did Elise Stefanik have to overcome?
Well, she was of the youngest female ever elected to Congress. I mean, when she first went to a report for her first day, they stopped her because they didn't think she was really a congressperson. I mean, that's what I'm talking about, is the assumptions that people make about your capacity based on your age, based on your appearance, based on your religion, whether or not you grew up in, you know, in poverty or not. I mean, I think her family is a they own a business, right? They own a
lumberyard,
wood business, right? So, I mean, it's not like she grew up at the hand of a Wall Street financier or something.
Right. And those obstacles can be invisible. Those can be very small. Those can happen between colleagues behind closed doors. So, I'm not saying privilege doesn't help.
Sexism is still rampant. Islamophobia is still rampant. Racism is still rampant. But I don't really view Elise Stefanik as struggling with those things.
All right. This is from Michael. I've read this letter twice. I'm not sure I understand it, but maybe you all can help me out. Long before the November 2025 election, Stefanik was selected to be Trump's foreign ambassador, but that was delayed for her to run for New York governor. The only purpose for that at the time was to position her to pardon Trump and mitigate the felony label on his resume.
Wow. There's a whole nother universe out there that I'm not.
I don't see how the governor. I don't think the governor of New York would have that
power.
Well, she could pardon him for the conviction in New York City.
Right. The state charges.
The state charges, but those were already thrown out. So I don't know if they were thrown out, but there's no ability to sentence him or fine him or anything.
Well, and no matter what happened. Or happens, she wasn't going to be governor until next year anyway, you know, to be elected, right? I mean, it wasn't going to be, so I don't quite understand the letter. But anyway, we welcome your letters. Dusty says that you mentioned that New York State is solidly blue, not so fast. I don't know where you live, but I'm in Columbia County, and you would be surprised. Well, we didn't say it was solidly blue. Actually, we said the opposite, but that's okay. You would be surprised at how many Trump supporters are here, not to mention when you go further west in the state. And this is the problem with showing pictures on the radio. That's the problem, because what I showed a graphic to the group here in Studio A at WAMC and showed a map that was 95%, all but six counties. Were red. And so I think, and we said that to the point, it's the population centers, it's not the, but when you look at the map as a whole, and I think Heather very astutely pointed out that this also mirrors the national map as well, that you don't really start seeing blue is on the coasts, and then that's about it. And weirdly around water. And then you
the
go.
Great Lakes.
Yes. Okay. So we love your letters. Elise Stefanik has a BA from Harvard. She does not have a law degree. Okay. Is that true?
I don't think so.
I swear.
I thought that was the case, but I don't know.
We're checking.
Okay.
I think that's correct. I don't think she has a law degree.
All right. I only hope she doesn't have a law degree, because that would mean the third listener in a row that we've eviscerated, and I apologize for that.
But I was only bad on the first one. The third one.
She's right.
This listener is correct.
Okay, there you go.
Yep. Excellent. A BA from Harvard, not a law degree. My apologies.
Raymond says, let's not forget that Elise Stefanik started the war against free speech when it comes to criticism of Israel by excoriating and cross-examining the heads of the universities for daring to allow student protests. She amplified the efforts to conflate political critique and anti-Semitism.
And the other point is, and this is could be a quiz game, a WAMC.org quiz game, other than being so tight with Trump, what are her actual accomplishments in the Congress? I mean, the four of us have had her or currently have her as our representative. I can't think of anything she's accomplished. Can you?
I'm taking myself out of
this. I was going to say, I don't follow these things. I've got nothing to say off the top of my head.
I follow it, and I can't think of anything she's accomplished. She speaks out a lot in support of Fort Drum up on the border.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, what's her signature accomplishment?
Well, without being overtly political, which I'm trying to avoid being, but let me just say, as a member of her constituency, and comparing her to past congressional representatives, Gillibrand, Chris Gibson, John Sweeney, Jerry Solomon. I could find them in I knew where to find them. They were around all the time.
They had town hall meetings.
They were out. They were about. They were at events. They were at everything that you would see. So that is very different because that is not the case here. And 10 points to Gryffindor for the person who can tell me the name of the congressional candidate that Elise...
The dairy farmer?
Yes.
Good something?
Good. No. Well, all right.
Gooder something?
I think the husband of the dairy farmer.
Well, the candidate, the Democrat who's trying to run against Stefanik is a dairy farmer.
Yes, but then there was but I'm talking about the last who should time? Be replaced. Who actually held the office of
Bill Owens.
No.
Wait, before Stefanik?
Yeah.
The husband of the dairy farmer?
Okay. I don't know. I'll come up with it. I'll look it up. Here we go, from Glens Falls. I gotta look that up. Okay. Also, wish I heard, in my opinion, Ms. Stefanik has been cowardly when it comes to coming on WAMC. Does anyone think her running is a sign of any sort of courage developed to try to reach all New Yorkers and perhaps be brave enough to be interviewed as a gubernatorial candidate on WAMC's air? I doubt that will happen. So, funny story, I was interviewing an author who wrote a book about women in Congress. And it was a bipartisan book of both Republicans and Democrats of women who had entered Congress. And I noted that the one person that she did not interview, it was Elise Stefanik. And she said to me, no, Elise Stefanik said that that the office said she only does local media. And I said, well, that's not true. She doesn't do local media. She'll do Fox, but she doesn't do local media. And so I do find that interesting as well.
Apropos of the book, I just want to point out at the theater in Latham, what is that called? There's a new theater in Latham. And this weekend they're running a play about Margaret Chase Smith, the Republican congresswoman from Maine who stood up to Joseph McCarthy. So there is a strong Republican woman who Elise Stefanik might want to base her future career on.
I think it takes a lot of courage to put yourself out there and run for governor. I'm just saying. I wouldn't want to do it. You're immediately going to be criticized for everything under the sun. And, you know, our lovely national media has a long track record of being particularly egregious in terms of describing women by their appearance, their clothing, their hairstyle, and all of that. I mean, I don't think it's an easy thing at all. And I think that's, you know, it does take courage. So I would not describe anyone who is publicly stating that they're running for a statewide office as being cowardly.
All right, let's move on and talk about other stuff as we move through this morning. And we welcome you to get into the discussion, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We go to this. I do want to talk about... let's see how I'm going to time this. Let's talk about the flight cuts, and then we'll get into, I promise, we'll get into the economic story here and on tariff and skepticism. So we'll do that after the break. All right. Flight cuts. And oh boy, isn't this going to be fun. So flight reductions, we talked about this a little bit. And I said this yesterday. Sometimes I have trouble remembering whether we talked about it on air or during the break. I know we talked about it during the break, but we touched on it a little bit during the show, I believe. Airlines will begin gradually reducing flights at some of the country's busiest airports, including those serving Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, Los Angeles, and D.C., beginning today. A move the Trump administration officials say is necessary to eliminate potential safety risks as the government shutdown, the longest in history, enters its second month. This isn't about politics. It's about assessing the data and alleviating building risk in the system as controllers continue to work without pay. That, according to Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy.
Former reality TV star.
Heather.
I am not a former reality TV star, although
a future.
It would be fun. I think. I mean, this
Heather is, on the farm.
My mm-hmm. 100-mile view on this is they've got to solve this shutdown. I mean, they have to solve it. This is damaging. I mean, it's impacting people, and whether or not a flight is delayed from this point forward. Any delay is going to be because of the shutdown, right? And so I've experienced delays in the last couple of weeks, and was, the narrative in the airport is that it's because of the shutdown. So everyone
well,
is.
There are actually announcements by Kristi Noem in
well,
many
no,
airports.
Not in Albany.
but in most airports right. around the country,
saying that it's because of Democrats.
They blame radical left Democrats for your delay.
But no one sure. is. No one is going to like right. like that. It's one of those things. If you say I say the shutdown is because of Democrats, and you say the shutdown is because of Republicans, it's just the same stuff we've been hearing from the beginning. Who's in charge? That's who gets blamed. That's how it always works. It doesn't matter how you explain it, how it's but it's they're trying to do something different. They voted for this 35 times before. It still gets pinned, and historically, it always gets pinned on the party in charge. So they need to end this. They have to figure this out. And if they don't, it's just going to be continuing damage, and it's harmful. I mean, it is hurting people. The flights are an inconvenience that nobody likes. It puts everyone in a bad mood, and they're going to want to blame somebody. This is the airlines have the perfect excuse. It's not our fault. We didn't do it. There's shortages in, FAA officials and flight traffic controllers and all of that. There's a lot of factors going into it. Now we know that moving forward, every single problem with an air flight is going to be related to the shutdown. So it's bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If air traffic controllers were legally allowed to strike, this government shutdown would be over yesterday. They have one of the most important jobs in the country. And not only is it one of the most important, but it's also very high stress. And right now, many of them are not being paid. If I'm actually... Is it all of them?
None of
them are being paid. My heart goes out to them. It's a really tough position to be in, and there's really not much that they can do. It's if I remember correctly, during the Reagan administration, there was a strike from the air traffic controllers. And,
right.
Yeah, it was pretty famous how. How Reagan handled that, essentially, just sort of kicking them to the curb. I feel like something like that might happen again. There's a lot of similarities between Reagan and Trump in terms of their, economic policies. It's interesting to see what will happen.
How much of this is a strategic tactic to, I mean, it's almost that, I don't want to say it's an academic debate, but it has a different flavor when you're talking about extending subsidies for the Affordable Care Act.
Or SNAP cuts.
Or, right, sure. Yes, right. Then it's, it's a political issue. It's a debate that happens in Washington, D.C. This seems like Trump's trying to take it to the streets.
I think he wants it to end. I mean, I think
well,
he...
I'm sorry, you should finish. I was just saying, like, this is probably a strategic tactic. This could be considered a strategic tactic to make this not some type of, wonky debate about healthcare subsidies, which a lot of people don't care about. They're not, they might not be affected by it, but you know, when you're flying around the Thanksgiving season, or when you're getting anxious about flying around Thanksgiving,
right?
Then all of a sudden, people get worked up. So I wonder if this is a strategy, to your point, and then I'll kick it back to you, about maybe trying to accelerate what is clearly going to be an impasse where neither side seems to be willing to budge.
Well, I mean, I think the election results have the Democrats feeling empowered that they don't need to cut a deal, mm-hmm. and that the Republicans are getting blamed for this, so let's just carry on. Now, you can take that argument and say, well, then this is the fault of the Democrats, right? But yeah. It's a complicated argument. You know, I think the subsidies were important now, but they weren't important before, even though everyone knew when they were expiring. Right. And by the way, these are COVID-era subsidies. So there's a good argument COVID is over. They were intended to expire by law at the end of the pandemic. And so there's a lot of moving parts here. I don't think anyone gains at this point. And I think there's a recognition. I think we're going to see movement in the next, you know, 4 to 5 days, probably. They can't let this go into Thanksgiving holidays. It'd be a disaster.
The number of flight cancellation ramps up
yep.
through the weekend.
Yeah.
You know who can gain from this is Amtrak. If you have a flight scheduled that short term, like to Ohio, take Amtrak instead.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll settle all of these matters and much more. First this.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. So we've got about, 10, 12 minutes left in the show. And I want to get to some other stuff from the news of the day. So let's talk about the Supreme Court. What was the story you sent me, Aaron? Did you send me a story?
Yeah, the not jobs report, jobs report.
Did I not include that?
You did.
You did. Yes, yeah, we got it. I was looking ADP. Forward to hearing Aaron talk about the jobs report.
It was the NBC News one.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't
third,
see it on
it's
my...
It's third on the list.
Wow, I'm bad, man. I don't know what happened. All right. So let us talk about that. Normally, we always love when Aaron comes in and talks about the jobs report. And because of the shutdown, there is no official jobs report. But there is data that comes to us from ADP, which is the...
We all know ADP.
Yes, we all knew ADP.
A
service that provides paychecks to companies throughout the country. Okay, so what do we find from their numbers?
So the short answer is numbers that are not good, but also consistent with what was happening before the BLS stopped releasing reports. So ADP is a private payroll processor, and last month when the BLS would report job numbers for September, ADP revised their estimate to a 29,000 job loss for the month of September. And then for October, which would have been the jobs report that the BLS released today, the report showed only a 42,000 gain. So beginning in the spring of 2025, job growth has come down from, you know, 150, 200,000 to 50,000, you know, you're averaging very low numbers that do not keep pace with population growth. And this is a very worrying sign, because now it's no longer 1 month of data where we say, okay, the jobs report came in really low, but let's not get all worked up about it because it's only 1 month. Well, now we've had about 6 months where the jobs numbers have been appallingly low and not statistically different from zero. So it's very clear that the labor market has pretty much stalled nationwide. It is pretty widespread. It's not something that is being concentrated in any single industry. So this is not a perfect report because it only looks at the private sector. It's not looking at government employment. It has a different methodology. The Bureau of Labor Statistics and government statistical agencies are the gold standard in economic data for Congress, the Federal Reserve, the financial sector, international financial institutions. Without that, all of these groups are making decisions in the dark. So in addition to that, the Conference Board, which does a separate survey on labor market conditions, has a somewhat different measure. And what they do is they ask their respondents, are jobs plentiful? And then they ask the same question, are jobs, quote, hard to get? So the difference between the percentage of the population that says jobs are plentiful and the difference between those that are saying hard to get has shrunk to the lowest level since 2021, which was, pre-vaccine COVID era. So it is very clear that the labor market is on the cusp of entering a vicious cycle where firms start laying off workers, and then there's less purchasing power in the economy, which leads firms to lay off even more workers. You couple this with the uncertainty surrounding tariff policy and the deportations, and we're essentially slowly moving along the runway to a pretty sharp economic slowdown. Whether that slowdown turns into an outright recession is something that is to be determined. But the president can appoint lapdogs to serve as the Bureau of Labor Statistics commissioner. The president can appoint lapdogs to fudge statistics or say whatever's in his favor. But the one thing the president can't fudge is people's reality of how easy or difficult it is to get a job. He can't fudge the reality of what the inflation report says and how much people are experiencing increased grocery prices, increased prices for everyday home supplies. This is another trend that is going to be working against Republicans, and I think has already started to work against Republicans with what we saw on Tuesday. This is only going to continue to get worse until the president reverses policies, which he is obviously unlikely to do.
Yeah, so, I mean, we do an employer survey quarterly, and this really tracks with what we've heard. And now this is New York State, but, these are just businesses inside of New York State, but close to 75% are not planning to expand in the next year or two. Two-thirds are saying that business is flat, down, or really down. That's two-thirds, right? These are some really not optimistic looking numbers. It also tracks that I think that there was some stability in the job market by kind of that masked some of the difficulties that were being faced nationally, because larger employers were hanging on to people because of their past experience having trouble filling positions, right? There was a huge, huge problem with workforce going back like 24 months or so. And so there was disincentive for employers to maybe let people go. That is pretty much gone away. So, I think that the numbers are probably accurate. Maybe when the new person gets hired by the federal government and comes in, we see some huge, major revision in numbers. On the ground, I think the reality is what it is.
Anything from our student guests?
How do the seniors feel about entering into a job market where businesses don't know whether they should be hiring or laying off workers?
Giovanna?
Oh, sure. I don't know. I feel a bit uncertain because obviously I have been networking and kind of getting to know people and like kind of just asking for their opinions, because I'm a big person where I believe like a gap year and like taking time to work and like kind of pay off your loans is the way to go in my sense. So it is kind of rather unsettling to kind of go into this market, but it's also like trying to make yourself stand out. And given the fact that the new mayoral elected Zoran has been elected, it seems like it's also going to be at least a little bit easier to afford to keep traveling, because something that I had to do was always travel to the city, and it adds up very easily. What is it? $2.70, right?
$3 now.
$3. Yeah. $2.90. Yeah. And then they're gonna bring it up again. And it's crazy because I've been working at this catering job since I was, like, in high school, and the pay bump just went up after, like, 3 years of doing it. And it's very difficult because it's also, like, trying to find a job that pays well as well. Because now, right. even if you do find a job, you're not getting the amount of pay that you were expecting, or that's enough to live comfortably in this city.
Well, I think... I think Giovanna raises some really good points. It's not just what your salary is. It's how much it costs to get to your job. And there are a lot of employers that will, in New York City, that give you a transit card, but not all. And yeah. it's typically for people who are middle income, higher income. And then, is the mass transit reliable? It often is not, both the bus and the subway. So if you're late for work, it's not your fault, but yeah. still the work is not being done. And I think that's why Zoran Mamdani was so appealing to so many people in New York City. But I think, you know, two other somewhat related points on the economy is I think the Trump immigration policies are really hurting small businesses. Who rely on people in the hospitality sector, farming, et cetera. And then the irony on the SNAP cuts is many people who apply for a job at Walmart, per se, while they're filling out their application, they're given an application for SNAP benefits. So they're not making a living wage,
yeah.
but they're encouraged to rely on SNAP. And I believe this is the first time in the history of SNAP, which used to be food stamps, that the money just entirely stopped for the participants.
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, in all honesty, this current job market is convincing me to stay in school, to go straight into my master's. you know,
and I don't want to go into the cruel world just yet.
Well, exactly. That's good for Sienna.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. But, you know, in a different economic environment, maybe I would, you know, just, you know, take a year or two, just try out like a job with my bachelor's and just then maybe go back for my master's. But, you know, part of me is just, you know, concerned about it. And maybe it's just the safer option to just, you know, continue my education and see how it turns out next year or the year after that.
Well, we wish you all the best of luck. And I know it's a long road, but I know you you certainly are up for the task and have a wonderful education behind you now and will and all do, I'm sure, very well. And if not, you can blame us. My thanks to our wonderful students this morning from Siena University, Josh Florence, Carrie Ann Wise, and Giovanna Perez. Thank you. You're wonderful. I appreciate you being here. We also thank Aaron Basidi, their professor, for bringing them to us. Heather Mulligan and Judith Enk, always a pleasure. We will continue with more Roundtable right after this.